This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hszc.org.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Well, right now, when I'm not bartending, I am been completely immersed in Tiantai Buddhism for the last weeks, couple of months. For a couple reasons. One is I'm working on an English language dictionary for Nichiren Shu, the order that I'm ordained in. And of course there are a lot of really good Buddhist English language dictionaries, especially the Princeton one, which I believe you have here. That one's just fantastic. I think that's the latest and the best. Right up close to that would be the Oxford one. But the problem is that for the purposes of Nichiren Shu, there's a lot of terms that are not in there, and a great number of those terms are from Tiantai Buddhism, which is the real, at least theoretical, basis of Nichiren Buddhism. And also I would say that pretty much all our practices are derived, are inspired by Tiantai Buddhism in one way or another. In fact, a lot more directly than I had ever thought, the more I delve into it. And the other reason is that I'm working on revising a manuscript I wrote way back in 99 that people, at least in the Nichiren community, have been wanting me to publish as an ebook. So I've been grinding my way through that, and now I've gotten about halfway through and I'm at the point where I'm going to talk about Nagarjuna and his two truths and Tiantai Jury and his three truths. So I'm rereading everything I read back then, reflecting on how much my perspective has changed through the years, through my own practice, reading things that were not available to me then, and basically just nothing but breathing and eating and thinking about Tiantai. Does anyone, here I've been going on about him for like the last 5 minutes, does anyone know who Tiantai Jury is?
Good if you give us a little background.
Yeah, okay. Sorry. Kasum. Tiantai Jury was a monk in 6th century China. He lived at a time when a good amount of the sutras, Mahayana sutras, had been translated. Kamarajiva, who was one of the great translators of sutras into Chinese, had done his work in the beginning of the 5th century. So Tiantai comes about 100 years after that, 150 years after that. So Tiantai had this huge mass of material that the Chinese were trying to make sense of, because, you know, this sutra said you should become an arhat and leave the life, cycle of birth and death forever, and this one says you should be a bodhisattva and stay involved and aspire to Buddhahood, and this one says that you can be a layman as wise as, you know, anybody except maybe the Buddha, maybe. I'm talking about Vimalakirti. And these other sutras say that you're not going to get anywhere if you don't become a monk. So there's all this conflicting material. And I think Tiantai was a genius in the way that he systematized this vast amount of material and systematized it in a way that was practical. Because right now, the way we understand how the sutras developed over time, Tiantai's classification system doesn't seem to hold water. You know, we know, for instance, like the Lotus Sutra, the Flower Garland Sutra, were not taught by the historical Shakyamuni Buddha, whereas he seems to have assumed that, and his structure assumes that the Buddha taught for 50 years and taught these sutras kind of at this time, and these sutras at the later time, and he was developing the disciples all the way through. And we look at this and say, well, you know, these ones didn't even appear until a couple hundred years after Shakyamuni's passing. But really, for the purposes that I'm concerned with, that's irrelevant. What is relevant to me is that Tiantai put all this together in a step-by-step system of deepening your understanding of Buddhist teachings, and deepening that understanding as you practice. And Tiantai laid out various different forms of practice, from silent sitting to ceremonial practices, to kind of almost proto-tantra practices, and just being aware of your mind as you go about the day, of your thoughts as they arise. So I'd like to share a little bit of that today, because I think a lot of Zen, early Zen, was very much informed by Tiantai's teachings and practices. And you know, research that's coming out now is confirming this. And one thing that is available now that wasn't available to me way back then, and I've been waiting since I was like 19 years old, 51 now, for this, is a complete translation of The Great Concentration and Insight, which is Tiantai Jury's meditation manual, basically. If anyone's familiar with the Visuddhimagga by Buddhaghosa, this blows it out of the water, at least as far as us Mahayana types should be concerned. Actually, the Visuddhimagga is great, too, and there's a lot of overlap, but there's a lot of stuff that's different, too, so it's worth reading both. But this is the core, I think, of East Asian Buddhism. This is the real core. And, you know, people like D.T. Suzuki talk about how the Hua Yan or flower garland teachings are the theoretical underpinning of Zen, but really there would have been no flower garland teachings if not for this. And a lot of the flower garland teachings were kind of reworkings of Tiantai material. And as far as us Tiantai Nichiren Buddhists are concerned, you know, not in a way that was really better. So, but that's like my little sectarian dig for today. I think I would like to start by sharing a passage from, if I can pull it up here, a book on Tiantai Buddhism that I highly recommend if anyone wants to get into this, called Emptiness and Omnipresence by Brooke Zipperin. Is anyone familiar with Brooke Zipperin? He teaches up at Northwest. Probably Tigan knows him, I'm sure. Let's see. Oh, geez. I took it off my Kindle. It's annoying. I don't know if I can get it back now. Yeah, no internet connection. All right, forget that then. It's a brilliant, whimsical passionate passage on how weird Tiantai Buddhism can get, which I would have loved to have shared, but it's not there. So I'm going to get right into the great contemplation and insight, or as Paul Swanson translates it, the clear serenity, quiet insight, the Moho Chi Kwan. I'd been wanting to read this since I was 19, because when I was 19, that's when I got involved in Nichiren Buddhism and started reading the translations of Nichiren's writings, and he was constantly quoting this, what in Japanese is called the Maka Shikan. And Nichiren's writings provided me a window into these teachings that were otherwise completely unavailable in the mid-late 1980s. And that was one of the big draws for me to practice Nichiren Buddhism, was, you know, on the one hand, the practice side, the visceral feeling of empowerment of chanting Namu Myoho-renge-kyo and passages of the sutra, the Lotus Sutra. And in the other side was the teaching of the 3,000 worlds in a single moment of thought, an idea that comes out of this text. And the idea that in every single moment of conscious awareness, everything is present. Everything mutually possesses everything else. So as it says in one of the passages here, the whole Dharma Dhatu, the Dharma realm, confronts the whole Dharma Dhatu in that moment of conscious awareness. So, the among other things that happens here in the Great there's no way I can even give you an overview in the time we have, but I'm just going to share a few things here and there. One of the things that he does, let's see if I can get to the right page here. Constantly, yes, here we go, 246. One of the things he does is he talks about the four samadhis, or states of deep concentration and unity. And there's been a lot of discussion over the past few centuries about which of these four samadhis is the most important. He lays out the samadhi of constant sitting, the samadhi of constant walking, the samadhi of walking and sitting, and the samadhi of neither walking or sitting. And those of you who like to read Nagarjuna and other people like that, this is also in the Pali Canon, these are the four alternatives. You know, there's A, then there's not A, then there's both A and not A, and then neither A or not A. So he's trying to cover all the bases, basically. This is a Buddhist way of covering all your alternatives, all your bases. And constant sitting is basically kind of what we just did previous, if you were here for the Zen session. Constant walking would be circumambulating around a statue of the Buddha, usually Amitabha Buddha, but it could be another Buddha like Medicine King, and reciting that Buddha's name and visualizing being in the presence of that Buddha. And the sitting and walking would be alternating periods of silent sitting meditation with walking and chanting and reciting sutras. And neither walking nor sitting, by which he really means just miscellaneous, consists of either more elaborate kind of ceremonies that, you know, have different modes of walking, sitting, or whatever, and more importantly, the constant mindfulness of one's thoughts as one goes about one's different activities. So there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, which of these is the most important practice. Is it constant sitting, or is it this constant mindfulness in daily life? But the way I read this, Tiantai is basically describing everything that a monk would do living in a monastery in China in the 6th century. He's not saying that any one practice is more important than the others. He's basically saying whatever you are doing, whether it's a particular kind of 90-day sitting practice you're engaged in, that would be like a whole retreat period, 3 months, or whether it's just, you know, raking the leaves after breakfast, you know, that's your moment of samadhi, whatever it is. But in particular, though, I would like to share what he says about the constant sitting samadhi and a little bit about what he says about the constantly being mindful of your thoughts, because I think that you'll hear how this could have informed the very early Zen tradition. And I think I would also, well, I'll get back to that later. So here's his description of constantly sitting samadhi. The first type of samadhi, constantly sitting, is derived from two Prajnaparamita sutras, the teaching of Manjushri and the questions of Manjushri, also called single practice samadhi. And you'll note that in most zendos, there's usually a statue of Manjushri right in the hall. Yeah, there you go. So I would not be at all surprised if that was because of this text. Now I will first clarify the methods for practice and then clarify the exhortations for cultivating these practices. Methods for practice. In this section on method, I discuss what promotes awakening and should be done, and what is a hindrance to awakening and should not be done with regards to the body. I discuss when and what to speak and when to be silent with regard to speech, and I discuss cessation and contemplation with regard to the mind. Body. As for what should be done physically, you should constantly sit and should avoid walking, standing, or lying down. Although it is possible to do this practice in a place with other people, it is better to be alone. Sit alone in a quiet room or in an open and peaceful place outside, apart from all the tumult and clamor of daily life. Sit on a coarse cot without any other seats or other clutter by your side. 90 days make up one period. Sit properly in a cross-legged position, with your neck and backbone perfectly straight. Do not move or waver or stoop or lean on anything. While sitting, vow to yourself that your ribs will not so much as touch the poles, let alone that you would sprawl face up like a corpse, prance about or stand up, except for walking meditation, eating, and going to the toilet. Face in the direction of a single Buddha image, sitting erect face to face with the Buddha continuously through time without faltering. Just sitting is what should be done, and you should not do anything that hinders this purpose. Do not deceive the Buddha, do not burden your mind with extraneous distractions, do not fool other sentient beings. Now he moves into speech. As for speech, when and what to speak and when to be silent, usually you should maintain silence. But if during sitting and meditation you become extremely weary or tormented by disease or overcome by drowsiness or if internal or external obstacles intrude upon and displace correct concentration mindfulness, concentrated mindfulness, so that you are not able to dispel these distractions, then you should singularly chant the name of a single Buddha, and with humility and repentance, trust in the Buddha as if your life depends on it. Singularly chanting the name of one Buddha is equal in merit to chanting the names of the Buddhas of all 10 directions. Why is this so? Just a moment. I'm going to use a little light here. Why is this so? It is as when people who are choked up with grief or joy are uplifted when they voice their emotions and cry out in sorrow or sing with laughter. It is the same for one who practices contemplation. When the inner wind of breath encounters the seven places of the body, the physical act for producing verbal sound is completed. And when the voice vibrates or echoes and emerges from the lips, the vocal act is completed. These two actions can assist in mentally perfecting your capacity for enlightenment and provide the opportunity to experience the Buddha who has bent down and descended to our level. Singularly, chanting a Buddha's name is like someone pulling a heavy load who is unable to advance by one's own power. By provisionally engaging the help and assistance of a bystander, the load can be lifted easily. The situation is the same for one who practices contemplation. When you are mentally weak and are not able to banish the obstacles to contemplation, chanting the name of a Buddha and soliciting his protection keeps evil conditions, such as those listed above, from destroying your concentration. If you still do not understand this teaching, you should approach those who understand prajna wisdom and listen to their instruction and practice and study accordingly. Then you will be able to enter the single practice samadhi and come face to face with the Buddhas and advance to the level of a bodhisattva. Nevertheless, even the chanting of sutras and spells breaks the stillness that is ideal for concentrated contemplation. How much more so for mundane speech? So, here is something a little different than Zen practice, as you're familiar with. This idea of sitting while facing a Buddha are at times when you're getting drowsy. Of course, notice that he's saying you should sit for 90 days without trying to sleep. So, of course, you're going to get drowsy. And then using, like chanting Nembutsu, for instance, the name of Amida Buddha or Medicine King or some other Buddha, to kind of wake yourself up, as opposed to being hit with sticks or something, you know, to wake yourself up, encourage you, etc. And of course, Zen practice, at least as I've been exposed to it and familiar with it, you know, you do alternate periods of meditation sometimes with chanting, although usually that would be like the Dharanis or Heart Sutra or things. If I'm understanding what he's saying, the chanting of like a simple phrase would be better than chanting sutra passages or dharanis for the purpose of this type of practice, this one practice, samadhi. So this idea of chanting like the name of a Buddha is a concession to your weakness is the approach taken here. All right, now he moves into talking about the mind. Cessation and contemplation with regard to the mind for the samadhi of constant sitting means to just sit properly and rectify your thoughts, remove evil notions, and abandon all distracting thoughts. Do not indulge in random conceptualizations and do not be attached to appearances. Singularly and steadfastly fix your thoughts on the Dharmadhatu as the object of contemplation, and integrate your thoughts with reality, the Dharmadhatu. Fixing on the objects corresponds to cessation. Integrating your thoughts corresponds to contemplation. So the world as subject confronts the entire world as object. And there is no duality here because whether as the object or the subject, everything's included, nothing's left out. So he's being a little playful here. He then goes on to a bunch of things that I'm not going to read about contemplating how everything is empty, everything is conventionally present, and everything is the middle. So not getting stuck on either of those two ideas because basically it's the same idea. And I could go on for quite a bit about that. But now I want to skip ahead to one passage where he's talking about being constantly mindful in one's daily life. Neither walking nor sitting through 21. Fourth is the samadhi of neither walking nor sitting. The methods of samadhi explained above involve the exclusive use of walking and or sitting, but this method is different from the above. It is called neither walking nor sitting in order to complete the tetralemma. But actually, it involves walking, sitting, and all other possible kinds of activity. This is what Master Nan Yue called the samadhi of following one's own thoughts. When a thought arises, this is used as the following object to cultivate samadhi. The Panchavimshati Sutra calls it the samadhi of awakened thoughts. Wherever your thoughts may tend to turn, all can be used to awaken your consciousness and attain clear understanding. Although there are three names, actually there is only one dharma. I will now rely on the sutras to explain the term fully aware, which means enlightened understanding. Thought refers to the numerous mental factors of cognition, and samadhi is as explained previously. When the practitioner's numerous mental factors arise, this person should reflect on, illumine, and contemplate them thoroughly, not paying heed to their fluctuations, origins, conclusions, from where they come or to where they go. Therefore, the samadhi is called fully aware of one's thoughts or awakened thoughts. The best I can understand this is he's saying, don't think about where did that thought come from or where is it going, but just look at the thought itself in its presence in the moment. And this phrase is particularly interesting. When the practitioner's numerous mental factors arise, this person should reflect on, illumine, and contemplate them thoroughly. And Stevenson, who had previously, another scholar had previously translated this beginning part of the Great Concentration and Insight, translated this as, one should turn back to reflect upon and discern them thoroughly. Stevenson adds in a note, the four character expression, fan chao quan cha, I don't know if I'm saying that correctly at all, but which we render turn back to reflect upon and discern is an extremely significant formula that appears frequently throughout Juryi's and Hui Su's works on meditation. Fan chao, which literally means to turn back and illumine, or to turn back one's illuminating, carries an almost cosmogenic sense of returning to the source or reversing the stream of deluded thought from which the entirety of deluded existence evolves. So that term I know that I've seen several times in the writings of various Zen masters, in particular Chenul, who was an early 13th century Zen teacher, who I've also had a lot of interest in and been inspired by. So I think you can hear in those two passages, you know, how much of that has informed or spilled over into Zen discourse on meditation. Let's see, it is 10:41. I think I'll share one more passage, this time not from the Concentration and Insight, but from the Profound Meaning of the Lotus Sutra, wherein Tiantai Juryi explains all of Buddhism through the lens of the Lotus Sutra. And he explains the Lotus Sutra by looking at the five characters of its name in Chinese, Myoho, Renge, Kyo, as the Japanese pronounce it. So because I've read this, and of course Nichiren quotes it a lot, you know, I realized that Namu Myoho Renge Kyo, when I say I realize this, I mean I realize this like 30 years ago, not just last week. Okay. That when you chant Namu Myoho Renge Kyo, it's not supposed to be some magical invocation. It's basically like each character and the five characters together is a way of encompassing and summing up and bringing to mind the entirety of Shakyamuni Buddha's teachings. And especially from the perspective of the Lotus Sutra, which is kind of a meta commentary on all the sutras. What's the purpose of each of these different teachings, from the Pali Canon to the Vimalakirti to the Heart Sutra? You know, and the purpose is to show that Buddhahood is active and present here and now in our lives, as our lives, among our lives, all of us together, right? And that's what these five characters are all about. Now, the passage I want to share is where he is talking about contemplating one's own ignorant thoughts, which kind of follows on from what I was just reading about the neither walking or sitting samadhi. And I found this passage really very intriguing. Fourth, contemplating the mind means contemplating that one ignorant thought is identical to enlightenment. The Mahaparinirvana Sutra says, insight concerning ignorance is identical to ultimate emptiness. Wisdom concerning emptiness illumines ignorance. It clarifies the truth that ignorance is identical to purity because they are both empty of substantial being. To use an analogy, suppose there is a man who is discovered to be a thief. He is then unable to steal. Swanson says he didn't understand the relevance of that, but what that means to me is I'm a bartender. Last night, in fact, I was bar backing, which means I was overseeing like the different bartenders, making sure they had all their ice and all their equipment and all that stuff, and also they're collecting tips in the back and all that. So if I knew that one of the bartenders was a thief, was someone that we suspected of taking money from the till or trying to slip, tip money into their pocket, well, then it would be a lot easier for me to catch that person. They wouldn't be able to get away with it. So in the same way, if I know that my thought, the thoughts that are arising, is an ignorant thought or an empty thought, and they're all empty, right? It won't fool me. I won't buy into the delusion. So I think that's what Jerry is saying here. Suppose there's a man who's discovered to be a thief. He's then unable to steal. If originally there is no place which is defiled by ignorance, then this way of passionate delusions is pure. Right? So if you see the ignorant thought and you see through it, it's no longer an ignorant thought. Now it's emptiness. Now it's opening up into awakened awareness. So, if passionate delusions are pure, then there are no karmic deeds. If there are no karmic deeds, then there are no bonds. If there are no bonds, then one is a free self. If one's self is free, one is not bound by karma. Who then experiences name and form, contact and experience? These are parts of the links on the dependent origination. Since there is no experience, there is no suffering. If there is no suffering within the aggregates, who then is transient and perishes? This is the virtue of eternity. Thus, one thought in the mind already includes the 12-fold links of conditioned co-arising. By contemplating these aspects of conditioned co-arising and constantly practicing the contemplation of eternity, bliss, selfhood, and purity, the mind will thought by thought come to dwell within the secret storehouse of Buddhahood. The constant practice of this contemplation is called being entrusted to the noble womb. If one practices this contemplation diligently and single-mindedly, one will bring to perfection the content of the womb and advance towards Buddhahood. If one destroys ignorance, this is called transcending the noble womb to advance to Buddhahood. So Tiantai's idea of meditation is that it's not fixed in any one particular form, and that you don't start with some idea of purity or wanting to go to the pure land or desperately wanting to get enlightened. You start with the ignorant thought confronting you right here and now. I had this experience sitting this morning as I was facing the wall and kind of wishing that I was facing that blank wall or that blank wall, and instead I'm looking at this dirty, what is that thing here? The cornice of this, and it's just like I'm just really becoming hyper aware of it. So I'm sitting there and I realize, this is meditation. I sit down and I have this idea of meditation, and what meditation is this awareness of this cornice here, of this corner. Just I had this thought that meditation is dissolving into resonances. And what I mean by that, or I guess what I meant to myself by that, because that was the thought that came up, is that I had this idea of meditation of just me here still with this like kind of joyful buzz of being still and silent. But really what the experience is the experience of being aware of this corner and then being aware of all of these thoughts about what I was going to say in this lecture, and then being aware of how there's still this resonance of being upset by a coworker who was rude to me last night, and having this, all these resonances of the rain outside and the sound of the heater coming on, and the feelings, the physical feelings along my back. And so the more I'm fully present to all of this stuff going on, the idea of sitting in meditation just completely dissolves into all these different resonances coming together, you know. And this is what Tian Tai is talking about in terms of things being empty, being conditionally present, being the middle way. You know, this, when you look into the experience of sitting meditation, it goes away. It dissolves into resonances. It's empty. But on the other hand, there are things that are very conditionally present. You know, this is a very concrete presence right here. My being upset about the rudeness of a coworker is very present right here. But if I shifted my attention to look at those things, they would dissolve too into other resonances. And the middle way is just the fact that this dissolving and appearing are really the same thing. It's all coming together and confronting itself as the whole, confronting and meeting the whole in every ignorant thought that comes up, whether you're doing the one samadhi practice of silent sitting or you're doing the walking about following your thoughts, turning the light back within. And this is all Tian Tai teaching. This is not Zen teaching. This is just straight out Tian Tai Juri. So I find it really exciting to have access to all this material now. And also exciting that unlike my 19-year-old self, I have like 32 years of practice now to help me reflect on these things that he's talking about, because he's talking about his own practice. So more resonances to go along with. So it is 10:50, so I'm going to stop my part of the presentation here, fixed part, and see if you have any comments or questions about any of this. Yes?
What you were saying a few minutes ago about the four characters.
Right.
The four Chinese characters. I'm pretty sure in Japanese that's Eko Hensho, which Dogen uses a lot. So yeah. There's definitely a connection there.
Right.
Also, I wondered if you might say a little bit about the way that shamatha and vipassana go way, way back in Buddhism.
Oh, yeah.
It's totally foundational for Buddhist practice.
As a matter of fact, you know, these characters here, these two, that's in Japanese, chikan, or chikwan, I guess, in Chinese, but I don't know how to pronounce Chinese, but that's shamatha vipassana right there. So maka shikan is the great shamatha vipassana. It goes way back to the Pali Canon, which Pali Canon wasn't the only recension of the historical Buddhist teachings, but it's the only one we have a complete version of. There are also the Buddha's early teachings up in China and Tibet, but they're more like one collection's from this lineage and this one's from this one. But the Pali Canon is all the Theravada. So that's, as far as I'm concerned, the closest we're going to get to the historical Buddha's teachings is the Pali Canon. There's like, and there are different strata within it, but we're not going to get past that to some other more original material. So that's as close as it gets. And that's where these terms come from of, you know, calming and looking, or stopping and looking, as Thomas Cleary said, or calming and contemplation. And they're kind of like the two wings that carry the bird of practice. And the vipassana part is what really makes Buddhism unique. Tian Tai talks about five kind of preliminary practices for beginners, which would be like counting the breath, cultivating loving kindness and compassion. That's the second one. The third one would be meditating on impurity, like the composition of the body and or decaying corpses. A fourth one would be contemplating the Buddha himself, which might sound like a unique Buddhist practice, but really you could do that with Krishna or Jesus or anybody. You know, it's just take an admirable figure and think about all their admirable qualities. And then the fifth one would be particularly Buddhist, dependent origination, like thinking about the 12-fold links. So these are five preliminary practices. And out of those five, only one of them, the last one, is particularly Buddhist. And those four are forms of concentration, of focusing on a particular object and calming yourself, focusing, getting centered. And that had been done a long time before Shakyamuni Buddha. In fact, he studied with two yogic meditation masters to attain states of nothingness and neither perception or non-perception. And he found that those states, while neat, you know, you have to come down eventually. You go back to your ordinary state of consciousness, and then all the greed, hatred, delusion is still there. You just had a reprieve, not a total break or transformation. So what Shakyamuni realized was you need to take that focused, concentrated mind and then use it to just look at the realities of this moment as per the four foundations of mindfulness. You know, look at form, look at your sensations in this moment that you're experiencing, look at your mental state. You know, is it excited? Is it calm? Is it distracted? Is it happy? Is it sad? And then finally, look at the dharmas, with small d, phenomena. Look at the phenomena just as they are, you know, which is what Tiantai is teaching. And then through that, you look deeply into these things and you see how they are. You see how they dependently arise and cease. You see their emptiness. You see how they're present through a coming together of other things. So that's the vipassana, or the insight part. And that's what makes the Buddha's method of teaching meditation different than, say, the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. You know, if you read the Four Foundations of Mindfulness and other Buddhist meditation texts, and then you read the, excuse me, Yoga Sutra of Patanjali, which appeared maybe first century BCE, a couple centuries after the Buddha, you might be surprised at how much overlap there is, especially cultivating jhana, cultivating loving kindness and compassion. There's a lot of overlap. So either Patanjali was influenced by Buddha's teachings of meditation, or he was drawing upon a common pool that existed before the Buddha. But what's different is there's not really this emphasis, I don't think he even mentions it at all, about vipassana, about contemplating and looking at the selfless or dependently arising nature of things. So that's really what makes Buddhism unique as a meditation practice. Okay, yes?
Michael, is there a distinction between thoughts and emotions? Because when you're very dealing with high emotion,
yeah,
you know, all I can think of is I'm mad.
Right.
Whatever. So there's not any other thinking that's going
right
on. So it's really hard to get a discernment at that point.
Yeah. Well, in the way that Tiantai arranged his scheme, and you see this in a lot earlier writings than his, like the Visuddhimagga, for instance. Actually, I think the Visuddhimagga was also like around the 5th century or something. So they were very close. But even in Pali sources, it's easier to go after the false views, right? Or false ideas about reality than the underlying kind of gut instinct and presumptions about how things should be, right? So, for instance, there are 10 fetters or bonds that keep people tied to samsara. And I find it really instructive looking at how those are broken down, because when you become a stream enterer, right, so in becoming a stream enterer, you can attain freedom from the world of birth and death within 7 lifetimes. If you become a stream enterer, you break through three of these fetters all at once, right? One is the false idea of the self, that there is some me here that I can find and distinguish from what is not me. So to break through that idea, to break through your doubts about your own practice, or the Buddha's teaching. And finally, to let me see if I get this right. The other fetter is like false views about causes and conditions, right? So that's relatively easy. But then the next step is to become the once returner. And the once returner takes care of two more fetters. They attenuate them. And those are greed and hatred, or attachment and aversion. Right? So it's easy to get rid of these false ideas of the self, or false ideas of, oh no, it wasn't exactly false views. It was over-reliance on external practices, like bathing in the Ganges, right, to purify your karma, things like that. So it's relatively easy to see through that stuff, but to get at the emotional stuff, that takes more doing. So the second stage, becoming a non-returner, you don't even cut off fetters anymore, you just weaken them. Hate, greed, and hatred. And in the third stage, the non-returner, so now you might be reborn in one of the higher heavens, like one of the pure abodes, kind of a proto-pure land that we have in Mahayana Buddhism. You can be reborn in one of those, and you'll finish off there and enter nirvana there. But at that point, you cut off greed and hatred. So it takes some doing. And then the fifth stage, the fourth stage, becoming an arhat, means cutting off the other five. And those other five are this need or desire to have some existence in the form realm, or the formless realm. All right, so what that means for us is to have some thought that, okay, maybe I'll never have this kind of experience again, this embodied physical experience with all these feelings of greed and hatred. But even if you get rid of that, there's still this primal need to have some kind of existence, some kind of transcendent existence that maybe is hard to imagine here, you know, in some realm of form that transcends our messy emotional life, or even some formless realm where there's not even form anymore. There's just this kind of enlightened consciousness floating around. So these very refined states so this is something that's like really deep within us, and we're usually not aware of it, not in any conscious way. But Buddhism is saying when you get through those other fetters, then there's that stuff. And that's not a false idea. It's a false assumption that goes beyond just having conceptual ideas, right? And then the other fetters would be restlessness, just a primal need to be doing something, which of course in sitting in Zazen, you're challenging that right off. Restlessness, pride or conceit, you know, this idea of, oh, look how much I've accomplished. And finally, fundamental ignorance, whatever that may mean, because different Buddhist traditions define it differently. But that fundamental misunderstanding about how things really are, or maybe even just a confusion, you know, how are things? Why don't I know how things are? Maybe the thought that you should know is the fundamental ignorance. So from a very, very early on in Buddhism, it's recognized that dealing with difficult emotions is much harder than dealing with false views or false ideas about practice. But eventually, you will start challenging those as well. And the way you challenge them is to sit through them. Yeah. Did you have a question? Comment?
Well, I'm thinking back to an experience I had some years ago. I met a Nichiren priest. And we got talking, and I know nothing at all about Nichiren. I still don't know anything about it. But I started talking about meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And he became very irritated.
Uh-huh.
And he said, it has nothing to do with Nichiren at all. And, I shouldn't. It was like I felt scolded.
Yeah, well, he is an idiot. No, he's a total idiot. Nichiren lectured on this text, the Maka Shikan, through his whole life. He mentions in his late letters to Mount Minobu that he was continuing to give lectures on this text. He mentions something about his meditation cushion. He, early on, He said that the wise, by which I think he meant the educated, not necessarily wise in a sense of like enlightened, the wise will chant Nam-myoho Renge-kyo and contemplate the 3,000 worlds in a single thought moment. The ignorant, meaning, you know, the illiterate and people who aren't educated, don't have time, should just chant Nam-myoho Renge-kyo. And later on, he put more and more and more emphasis on just chanting Daimoku, especially because of certain tendencies within the Tendai school at the time in Japan to try to sort of trump Shakyamuni Buddha's teachings with the Makkah Shikan itself. You know, so he lectured in this text, but he never set this above Shakyamuni Buddha's teaching. So, you know, did Nichiren actually practice silent sitting meditation at all or towards the end of his life? You know, I don't know. I do know in Nichiren Shu, we use silent sitting as kind of a preliminary before chanting Daimoku at times. My teacher, the Venerable Yusho Matsuda, every first Sunday in San Jose, at the San Jose Temple, they do sitting meditation. First time I showed up there, and I said the same thing to him. I thought Nichiren Buddhists didn't meditate. And he kind of looked at me like, what? Of course we meditate. All Buddhists meditate, is what he told me. Now, chanting itself is meditation. Chanting itself is very much meditation, as Tiantai makes clear here. It's just not silent sitting, focusing on the breath type of meditation. And I would wonder if that person, you said they were a priest, really?
Yes.
Are you sure?
From Japan.
Oh. They weren't Nichiren Shu, though, probably.
I don't know enough to answer the question.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. He might have been Nichiren Shoshu, which is what Soka Gakkai used to be connected with. But, you know, there are, I have to admit, there may even be some, Nichiren Shu's a pretty big tent. So there may even be some Nichiren Shu priests out there of kind of ideas like that. But I do know that in Nichiren Shu, one of the main practices that we teach is called Shodagyo meditation, in which we'll sit silently for maybe 5-10 minutes, and then we'll start chanting Daimoku very, very slowly with a taiko drum, and then speed it up until we're chanting really fast, raising a lot of energy, and then we'll slow it back down again, and then go back into a silent sitting period to just kind of abide in that afterwards. And you know, and if it were a Nichiren Shu priest, and I did run into this Nichiren Shu priest, and even if they were Japanese, I would point out to them what I just told you. Nichiren lectured on this his whole life. And, you know, I found that many of the Japanese priests have and I'm including my school here, have a very shallow understanding of Buddhism. I'm constantly involved in, you know, translating texts or revising texts that were translated or working with other Nichiren Shu priests on different documents. And I'm sometimes kind of shocked. I'll give you one example that drives me crazy. Senshu Murano was, he passed away, I think, in 1999, but he did a lot for Nichiren Shu in the United States. He was a priest here, I think, the Seattle Temple for a long time. He translated the Lotus Sutra, and it's a pretty good translation. It's the one that we use in Nichiren Shu. But he had a lot of ideas that were just, I think, flat out wrong. I asked him once why he didn't translate the opening and closing sutras of the Threefold Lotus Sutra. And he goes, oh, those aren't important. Like, excuse me, Nichiren quotes those all the time. Those were like major, especially the opening one, Sutra of Innumerable Meanings. That was like a major proof text for Nichiren to show the importance of the Lotus Sutra. You know, if Nichiren quotes it, a Nichiren Shu priest shouldn't be saying, that's not important. The other thing that he did that I think is more egregious is he bought into this whole thing from mid-20th century scholarship about how, you know, like two-thirds of Nichiren's letters, well, let's say half, you know, we can't prove that he wrote them or not. There's no concrete evidence that he wrote them, and they may have been attributed to him, and trying to figure out what Nichiren wrote and what he didn't. And some scholars got this idea that anything that mentions the thought of medieval Tendai original enlightenment could not have been written by Nichiren. You know, if he mentions the phrases, the defilements are themselves awakening, Bano Soko Bodai, or that Nirvana is samsara is Nirvana, Shoji Soko Nihon, then then that shows the influence of medieval Tendai original awakening, and so Nichiren couldn't have written that, you know, throw it out. And Century Murano bought into this, and he was telling these American people that, you know, all that stuff is not legitimate Nichiren Buddhism. Excuse me, Nichiren quoted this stuff all his life. If you took out all the quotes in the Nirvana Sutra, the Lotus Sutra, Tiantai's writings, Miao Lo's writings, a later Tiantai scholar who annotated this, there would barely be anything left. And if you look into these texts, those phrases, defilements are themselves awakening, and the world of birth and death is itself nirvana, they're all through here. That's not from medieval Japanese original awakening thought. How ignorant. And the phrase, there is no difference between nirvana and samsara, is in the Mula Majjhima Karika by Nagarjuna. So, you know, these Japanese priests, sometimes they have very narrow views, and they've only really been trained to do memorial and funeral services. And if they read anything outside of that, well, good on them, but they're few and far between. And then if they read outside their own narrow sectarian boundaries, even stuff that their own founders quoted, well, wow, you met one in a thousand. So anyway, my old diatribe there.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions or comments?
Are you saying that American schools of Buddhism are, in a sense, more informed?
I am saying that. I am absolutely saying that. And I'm saying that for Nichiren Buddhism. I'm saying that for Zen Buddhism. I'm saying that for Tendai and Shingon, all of them. Because, you know, there is a barrier. And some of these guys, I've had the great fortune of practicing with and learning from and doing translation work with some priests from Japan who are like, I have so much respect for them. But I'm talking the average run-of-the-mill, the 95%. And most of these guys, they're priests because their family was before them, going back several generations now, at least to the 19th century when priests started getting married in Japan. And to them, it's just a family business. And even outside of that family business aspect, you know, Japanese Buddhism's like a bento box. Everybody has to have their little thing in a little corner, you know, blocked off from everything else. And then they lose what their founders had, which was a wide-ranging knowledge of Buddhism. And Dogen, Nichiren, even Honen, all those guys knew much more than just their own thing, their own little specialty. Even if they didn't emphasize it or talk about it much, they knew this material. So Americans and Europeans and other people who are coming to Buddhism for the first time, we don't take anything for granted. I know I didn't. I couldn't. We don't take anything for granted. You know, we have to really look into everything to make sure that we understand it and understand it correctly, understand it in context. We're looking at it fresh. We're looking at it with eyes that are not bound by centuries of sectarianism and invested interests. I think we have a much better chance of, getting really to the heart of Buddhism than people who just grow up with it, take it for granted, and are full of biases and prejudices. But I'm not saying that we should not have any connection. I think one of the great things about Nichiren Shu is that we've maintained our connection with Japan very closely. And so, you know, and especially Nichiren Buddhism is very much more contextualized than I would say even Zen. You know, you don't need much context to sit and be quiet and face a wall. But when it comes to chanting sutras and this kind of talking about 3,000 worlds in a single thought moment, it's all very heavily contextualized. So, you know, to be able to meet with the priests in Japan who do know their stuff and are willing to help and are very interested in passing on, you know, these methods and this practice and these teachings, you know, that's immensely helpful and helps to overcome the big language barrier. And also, you know, we have our own biases and prejudices. Far too many converts to Nichiren Buddhism approach this ideas, the idea of, like, say, the eternal Buddha as if he was just Jesus with, you know, with a gloss of the Buddha over him. And it's not like that. It's not like that at all. So we have to beware of our own mistaken assumptions and biases that we may not even be aware we have, you know. So
a constant battle.
It's fun. it's an exploration. I would say exploration rather than battle. Yeah. Sometimes it's a battle, but very rarely, in my experience. So, okay. Well, shall we end it there on that more positive note? After I finish slagging most of the Japanese priests. I didn't mean to do that, but anyway. Thank you all very much, and I really treasure the opportunity to share these teachings of Tiantai Juri that, you know, meant so much to me in my own practice, and hopefully can mean so much to many, many more people, especially now that people like Paul Swanson has done this huge amount of work translating this.